From Troy Public Radio, this is In Focus Weekend, and I'm Carolyn Hutchison. Well, the official start of summer is just around the corner, but the frenzy to find something to read is already on. We're jumping in on the book craze by launching a new weekly series on In Focus called The Storyline. This weekend, we have two stories to celebrate our new series and let you know about our new podcast. Later in the show, we'll be speaking with author Jonathan Eig about his new biography of Martin Luther King Jr. But first, we speak with Don Noble, who is known across the state of Alabama for his program, Book Note, which airs on Alabama Public Television. Noble is launching a new podcast series with Troy Public Radio, in which he reads works by Alabama authors and about Alabama. Recently, I spoke with Don Noble to find out which works he plans to include. Don Noble, it is such an honor to welcome you to Troy Public Radio.
It's a pleasure to be with you again. We've done this once before, I think.
Yes, we have, with your lovely wife some years ago. But today we are focusing on you, and your fans know you as the host of Alabama Public Television's Bookmark with Don Noble. And here you are launching a podcast called Alabama Aloud with Troy Public Radio. How did this come about?
Well, it is a kind of natural extension. I've been interviewing Alabama writers and reviewing books by Alabama writers for well more than 30 years. And I do like reading fiction out loud, so it was a natural kind of next step. And I was a fan of Dick Estelle, Radio Reader. There are different times in my life when I would commute, and it just so happened that I would be in my car listening to him. And of course, he did 300, 400 page books of biography and history. We're going to stick with shorter things and for a while, short stories. But I liked it, and I always thought I could do that.
And Don, so many of your listeners here at Troy Public Radio remember Dick Estelle, and we've interviewed him before. So here you are stepping into this role, so to speak. So how have you chosen what you're going to do?
The producers and I have talked about it considerably. And first of all, they have to be good stories. They have to be entertaining. And in this first season, we're really coming down on the lighter stories and some comedy. The first 10 or 20 or 30 stories that we do will be entertaining.
Give us some examples here.
I've got several stories that are already recorded. I've recorded a story called Full Boat by Daniel Wallace. I've recorded a very funny story that takes place in Mobile in the Spring Hill District called Smash and Grab by Michael Knight. There's a wistful story by Tom Franklin. Franklin is best known for Hell at the Breach, which is a serious novel, but I've recorded a short story of his called Alaska, in which a couple of young men daydream about escaping their dull lives and driving to Alaska and what they will do on the way. There's a fairly comic story by Jennifer Horn that I've recorded called The Other Shoe for Troy. I think I've probably recorded 8 or 9, but I'm going to record 25 or so, and we're going to call that a first season.
Austin Toy is your producer, and Kyle Gassett is your executive producer. One reason we're excited about this is that you're bringing the printed word to people who cannot read the printed word. People who are sight impaired, they do not have access to Alabama authors. So what you're doing is bringing these tremendous stories not only to your listeners who are sighted, but to those who don't have access to the stories otherwise.
I'm aware of that, and I have found and recorded a story by Brad Watson, a brilliant fiction writer, and the story is told from the point of view of a service dog, a seeing eye dog. The story is entitled Seeing Eye, and it's from the dog's point of view, and it will be on here shortly.
It's going to be a great story, obviously. Now, I want to comment on your voice. I am a longtime fan of yours on Bookmark. I try not to miss it, and you've interviewed some of my favorite authors. But you're not from around here, Don. Give us the story of why you gravitated to the South and specifically Alabama.
Well, I went to college and I got a BA and an MA in Albany, New York at the State University in Albany. My entire time there, I was primarily interested in American literature. And I have done a lot of work on Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Steinbeck, and so on. But I found Southern literature absolutely exotic. I felt about Southern literature as if I were reading about Papua New Guinea or Samoa or something. It was a totally different culture for me. I'd never seen a cotton field. I'd never seen a mule. I don't know that I'd eaten grits under that name. So when it came time to get a PhD, I looked around, and the place in 1965 to get a PhD was the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Hugh Holman and Lewis Rubin were practically the inventors of Southern literature as a literary field. So I went there and got a PhD, and I have said this before, but it's still true. After 4 years living in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, I thought I had lived in the South. And so when I got an offer from the University of Alabama, I thought, well, that's fine. I'm used to living in the South, so I took the offer and I came here. It took me not very long to realize that West Alabama is not the same thing as Chapel Hill. It was really more Southern by far than Chapel Hill. But, you know, I just settled right in, and now in 3 or 4 weeks, I will have been here in town in my house for 54 years.
You have added incredibly to the South through your bookmark program. And how does it feel to morph from interviewer to reader of these folks' works?
You know, there's a certain amount of anxiety connected to it, I must confess. I really want to do these stories justice. I'm not a professional actor. I can read the prose that's on the page in front of me. I rehearse, I read silently, and then I actually rehearse out loud. I don't try to do voices. It'll be my voice with intonations to suggest character. And of course, the stories are by men and women, black writers and white writers, and the characters are therefore all kinds of people in the stories. I'm not trying to imitate, as an actor might, a real accent. I'm just suggesting it. Basically, I'm following the old Dick Estelle model, which was do it mostly in my own voice with some suggestions.
I remember interviewing Dick Estelle 1 year, and we had some technical difficulty. We were live on the air and dropped out, and he called the station back and demanded to be put back on the air. So he was certainly enthusiastic about what he did. As we are celebrating Alabama Aloud, your new podcast, which is accessible wherever people get their podcasts, how did you come up with that title?
Well, that was really a group effort. Kyle and Austin and I were trying to figure out what conceivably to call it. I think we may have started off with something like Alabama Literature Read Aloud and condensed it. And then we realized that it was a kind of a pun. A-L-L-O-W-E-D is in there, too.
Don, finally, you're talking right now to people in Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, three radio stations plus online. What do you want to say to them?
Well, first of all, I just hope that they enjoy hearing the story. When I've communicated with all the different authors whose work I'm using, and they all give permission, one of the things that we all hope, I hope, and the authors hope, is that if you hear a story by Tom Franklin from the collection called Poachers, you might go get the book and read the other stories in Poachers. Same thing with, say, Brad Watson. I've got a story by Watson called The Last Days of the Dog Men. It's a volume of stories in which every story has a dog. If you like the story about the seeing eye dog, maybe you'd go and read the collection. And that's true for all the authors whose stories I've used.
Thank you for your time, Don. We are honored that you are going to be on the Troy Public Radio airwaves and sharing your talent with your listeners.
I am delighted to do it.
That was Don Noble, the host of Alabama Public Television's Book Note and the new podcast, Alabama Aloud, from Troy Public Radio. The podcast will be available soon wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, author Jonathan Eide talks about his new book that focuses on how Martin Luther King Jr.'s time in Montgomery shaped his civil rights leadership. That's ahead on In Focus Weekend, so stay tuned. From Troy Public Radio, this is In Focus Weekend, and I'm Carolyn Hutchison. Next, you're going to hear the first interview in our new In Focus book series, The Storyline. His book, King, A Life, delves into the backstory of Martin Luther King Jr. and the trajectory of social change that he led. We concentrate on Dr. King's Montgomery connection and how it shaped his mission. Jonathan Eig, thank you so much for joining us from New York.
Thank you.
I want you to take us back to his office in the parsonage in Montgomery. There's a picture of Gandhi in there. How did King receive his calling from God?
Well, you know, King grew up in the church. His father and his maternal grandfather were both preachers, and so it's no surprise that he would go into this line of work. But it wasn't until he got to Montgomery and found himself thrust into this position of leading this bus boycott that he really first describes hearing the word of God, where he felt like God actually spoke to him and told him not to worry, that he could go forth and lead, and that this was what God wanted him to do. And that was a really crucial moment in the young King's life. He was only 26 years old, remember, when he found himself leading this bus boycott.
And on page 166 of your book, he talks about the significance of Montgomery in that calling and in his work. Can you share that paragraph?
He wrote, "The experience in Montgomery did more to clarify my thinking on the question of nonviolence than all of the books that I had read. Living through the actual experience of the protest, nonviolence became more than a method to which I gave intellectual assent. It became a commitment to a way of life."
So among the new discoveries that you made about his life, what stood out?
What really stood out for me was the fact that he was uncertain. You know, we think of him as being this great leader, this great American hero, but he had doubts, he had insecurities, he suffered, you know, at times from anxiety. In fact, even before the night of his most important speech in Montgomery, the speech where he really introduced himself to the people of Montgomery, he had a panic attack. He had 20 minutes to write that speech, and after 10 minutes of a panic attack, he basically gave up trying to write something and pushed himself out the door and decided he was going to have to improvise. I was just really struck by the fact that King, once you really look into the details of his life and once you talk to people who knew him, he emerges as a much more human figure.
Why was he so convinced that nonviolence was the way to achieve civil rights?
Well, it was complicated. You know, he had studied Gandhi and Thoreau and others in college, but when he got into Montgomery and the boycott began, that's when it began to become clear that the commitment to nonviolence gave him a kind of moral higher ground. He was able to position himself, and the black people of Montgomery who were staying off the buses and walking to work every day were able to assume this moral authority by saying, "We are so committed to this cause that we will suffer for it. And even if that means suffering physically at the hands of our violent tormentors, at the hands of the Ku Klux Klan, we will not strike back. We will prove that with our love, we deserve a place in the American fabric. With our love, we will prove that we are as good as anybody."
There are a couple of phrases in your book that encapsulate that. One is victory without violence, and the other is pacifism, added moral clarity. And yet, as the civil rights movement evolved, there were a number of organizations and people who kept clamoring for violence. Who were they?
Well, there were plenty of people who felt like Martin Luther King was weak. They confused his pacifism with weakness. And King maintained that it took more strength not to fight back. But that didn't satisfy everybody. And there were plenty of people who said, "Yeah, I'll march with you, Dr. King, but if somebody hits me, they're going to get punched back." And then there were others like Malcolm X or Stokely Carmichael who insisted that black people needed to defend themselves and that the only way they were ever going to get the respect of white authorities was to pose a threat. Dr. King thought that there was a very different kind of threat that they could pose, that they could throws a moral threat without necessarily a violent threat.
And the gossip in that era was that he was either a communist or influenced by the communist philosophy. What did you find out in your research?
You know, there were a lot of former communists involved in the civil rights movement. But then again, there were a lot of former communists all over America in the 1950s and 60s, former communists with ties to presidents. So that's not shocking because the Communist Party of America had a lot of influence, especially in the 40s and 50s. King had very close advisors who did have communist ties, but he had no interest in communism. He felt like he was trying to make American democracy better. In many ways, his true patriotism was overlooked because what he was really saying is that we don't want to tear down America. We don't want to junk the system. We want to join the system. We want to make it a more just and equitable system for all.
What was his relationship with President Johnson? You talk in the book about J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director, well known for getting dirt on people or information. But what about President Johnson?
We know a lot more about the relationship now because of the release of these new FBI documents and the release of the tapes that Johnson made from his White House. And one of the interesting things is that when Johnson takes office, he calls King right away and tells him, I really want to work with you. I need your help. And he calls him Martin. They have a really friendly conversation. Gradually, that friendship really begins to fall apart. And you can hear LBJ starting to call him Dr. King and Reverend King. And a large part of that is because J. Edgar Hoover is feeding Johnson steady information with memos about King's personal life, about his ties to communists, about his opposition to the Vietnam War, an area where LBJ is very sensitive. And both men really seem to enjoy spying on King and gossiping about his personal life. So the relationship is really undermined. What in many ways was the strongest relationship between an activist and a president in American history really came undone because of the work of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI.
You paid tribute to Coretta Scott King, and you said in the book that her courage matched her husband's.
It's true. And in fact, I think that's the main thing in the beginning, at least, that really attracted Martin Luther King to Coretta, is that she had more experience as an activist than he did. She went to Antioch College, an integrated college, and was active with the NAACP and with protests on campus. And when they met, King was really excited to find somebody who was as passionate as he was and who even had more experience. But because of the roles of women in society at that time, and especially the way that Baptist preachers viewed the role of women, she was really relegated to housekeeping and raising the children, and she was frustrated by that. Nevertheless, she continued to push her husband and continued to get out on her own as much as she could, at least, to join the movement.
Reading your book, there are eerie similarities to what is happening today. Expound on that.
You know, we're still struggling with the idea of whether Black history should be taught as part of American history. We had celebrated the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation when King was alive and Kennedy was in office, and there was a lot of debate about how we should teach the Civil War. Should we teach the idea that this was a battle between two equal sides? How much of the war was actually fought over slavery? The same questions that we're hearing today, really. Also, some of the things that King talked about as he gained fame and moved beyond Montgomery, you know, he began to talk about the fact that racism in the North was just as bad as racism in the South, that segregation in the schools was just as bad in the North as it is in the South, and those things are still true today. King talked about reparations. He talked about police brutality. Many of the issues that he addressed still haunt us today.
It is an epic book, and thank you, Jonathan, so much for being here with us. Because in this month, we have Juneteenth coming up.
That's right. There are still so many great stories from our history that we need to learn. And this history is our history. It's not just Black history. It's all of our history.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Thanks for doing this.
That was author Jonathan Eig speaking about his new book, King, A Life. Eig's book was published 2 weeks ago. Thanks for listening to our special literary-themed show. We hope you enjoy us over the noon hour each weekday, especially on Thursday for our new series, The Storyline. If you happen to not be around a radio, just download our show wherever you get your podcasts. This is In Focus Weekend, and I'm Carolyn Hutchison, hoping that your weekend is great. This is Troy Public Radio.